Disc 3.
With the presence of the Syrian army, the warring factions that had slaughtered each other in the streets of Beirut since the mid-1970s had more or less gone to ground. Muslim and Christian emissaries were rumored to be meeting at Taif, in Saudi Arabia, to formalize the ceasefire accord, but armed militias still patrolled the city, which sprawled like a mutilated virago at the edge of the Mediterranean, its shell-ridden buildings mute testimony to the brutal 15-year civil war. As the sun dipped into the sea and darkness enveloped Beirut, the wetted crack of distant gunfire reverberated through the city. Abdullah, visibly edgy, muttered something about old scores being settled before the formal ceasefire came into effect. Careful not to stray from the Muslim-controlled areas of Beirut, he guided the driver to the port area and deposited Dante on a corner opposite the burnt-out shell of a neighborhood mosque. A narrow street angled off downhill toward the docks.
"We will wait for you here," Abdullah told Dante. "Please to be returned by the hour of 10, so we can be returned to the camp by the midnight."
On the narrow street, broken neon lights sizzled over a handful of bars that catered to the seamen from the ships docked at the quays or tied to giant buoys in the harbor. Waving cheerfully at his keepers, Dante skipped down the sidewalk and, ducking to get under a broken neon tube dangling from its electric cord, shouldered past the thick rug that served as a door into the first bar, set up in a mercantile building that had been gutted by a direct hit from a mortar. The charred rafters that held up the jury-rigged sloping roof had been whitewashed, but they still stank from the fire. Dante found a place at the makeshift bar between two Turkish sailors holding each other up and a Portuguese purser wearing a rumpled blue uniform.
"So now what will your pleasure be?" the barman called,
a distinct Irish lilt to his gruff voice. Dante punched a hole in the cigarette smoke that obscured his view and spoke through it.
"Beer and lots of it," he called back. "The warmer the better."
The bartender, a thick man with a shock of tousled rusty hair spilling over his eyes and a priest's white shirt buttoned up to his neck, plucked a large bottle of Bulgarian beer from a carton at his feet. He flicked off the metal cap with a church key, stopped the throat of the bottle with the ball of his thumb, and shook the beer to put some life into it, then set it on the counter in front of Dante.
"And will your lordship be wanting a mug to drink from?" he inquired with a laugh.
"Do you charge for it?" Dante asked.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, why would we want to do that? You're paying such an outrageous price for the goddamned beer, we supply the mug at no extra cost to yourself."
He slid a freshly washed mug down the bar to Dante.
"Now what ship did you say you were off?"
"I didn't say," Dante shot back. "It's the HMS Pinafore." The smile froze on the bartender's face.
"HMS Pinafore, did you say?"
Dante filled the mug, swiped away the foam with the back of a forefinger, and, tilting back his head, drank off the beer in a long, gulping swallow.
"Ah, that surely transforms the way a man sees the world," he announced, starting to fill the mug again.
"HMS Pinafore, that's what I said." Accepting this with a brisk nod, the bartender made his way to the far end of the bar and, blocking one ear with the tip of a finger, spoke into a telephone. Dante was halfway through his second bottle of Bulgarian beer when the woman appeared at the top of the broken wooden steps that led to what was left of the offices on the upper floor of the mercantile building. A sailor buttoning his fly trailed behind her. The woman, wisps of long dark hair falling across a face disfigured by smallpox scars, was wearing a tight skirt slit high on one thigh and a gauzy blouse through which her breasts were as visible as they would be if she'd been caught walking naked through a morning haze. All conversation ceased as she walked across the room, her high heels drumming on the wooden floorboards. She stopped to take her bearings, spotted Dante, and installed herself at the bar next to him.
"Will you buy me a whiskey?" she demanded in a throaty murmur.
"I'd be a horse's ass not to," Dante replied cheerfully,
and he held up a finger to get the bartender's eye and pointed to the woman.
"Whiskey for my future friend."
"Chivas Regal," the woman instructed the bartender. "A double."
Dante authorized the double with a nod when the bartender looked at him for confirmation, then turned to scrutinize the woman the way he'd been taught to look at people he might one day have to pick out of a counterintelligence scrapbook. As usual, he had difficulty figuring out her age. She was Arab, that much was evident despite the thick eyeliner and the splash of bright red on her lips, and probably in her 40s, but exactly where he didn't know. It occurred to him that she must be Christian, since Muslims would kill their women before they'd let them work as prostitutes. "So what would be your name, darling?" Dante asked. She absently combed the fingers of one hand through her hair, brushing it away from her face. Two large silver hoop earrings caught the light and shimmered.
"I am Jamila," she announced. "What is your name?"
Dante took a long swig of beer. "You can call me Irish."
"From the look of you, you have been at sea for a while."
"What makes you think that?"
"You're dying of thirst. I can see that from the way you gulp down that disgusting Bulgarian beer."
"What else are you dying of, Irish?" Dante glanced at the bartender, rinsing glasses in a sink just out of earshot.
"Well now, Jamila, to tell you the god-awful truth, I haven't been laid in a month of Sundays. Is that a predicament you could remedy?"
The Portuguese purser, sitting with his back to Dante, could be heard snickering under his breath. Jamila was unfazed.
"You are a direct man," she said. "The answer to your question, Irish, is, I could."
"How much would it set me back?"
$50 US or the equivalent in a European currency. I don't deal in local money."
"Bottoms up," Dante said. He clicked glasses with her and downed what was left in the mug, grabbed the half-empty bottle of beer by the throat, in case he needed a weapon, and followed her across the room to the stairs. At the top of the stairs, she pushed open a wooden door and led Dante into what must have once been the head office of the mercantile company. There was a large desk, covered in glass with photographs of children flattened under it near the boarded-over oval windows, and an enormous leather couch under a torn painting depicting Napoleon's defeat at Acre. A dozen sealed cartons without markings were stacked against one wall. Locking the door behind them, Jamila settled into the couch and, reaching through a torn seam into the cushion, produced a folder filled with 8x10 aerial photographs. Dante, settling down alongside her, used his handkerchief to grip the photographs and examined them one by one.
"These must have been taken from high altitude," he remarked. "The resolution is excellent. They'll do nicely."
The woman offered Dante a felt-tipped pen, and he began to draw arrows to various buildings in the camp and label them. "The recruits, 19 fedayeen in all, live in these two low buildings inside the perimeter fence," he said. "Explosives and fuses are stored in this small brick building with the Hezbollah flag on the roof. Dr. Al-Karim lives and works in the house behind the mosque. It is easily the largest in the village, so your people won't have a problem identifying it. I don't know where he sleeps, but his office looks out at the mosque, so it must be..." He drew another arrow and labeled it K's office. "Here, I bunk in with a family in this house in the village."
"What kind of security do they have at night?"
"I've strolled around the camp after dark several times. They have a roadblock manned by two recruits and one of the instructors, stationed here where the road curves uphill to the village and the camp. There's a bunker with a heavy machine gun on top of the hill over the quarry, which is manned during the day. I've never been able to get up there at night, because the gate and the perimeter fence is locked, and I don't want to raise suspicions by asking for the key."
"We must assume it is manned at night. They'd be fools not to. The machine gun must be a priority target.
What kind of communications do they have?"
"Don't know, really. Never saw the radio shack, or a radio for that matter. Spotted what looked like high-frequency antennas on the top of the minaret of the mosque, so whatever they have must be something around there."
"We don't want to bomb a mosque, so we'll have to take that out by hand. Does Dr. Al-Karim have a satellite phone?"
"Never saw one, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have one."
"When will this round of training be finished?"
"I've told Dr. Al-Karim I needed 10 more days."
"What happens then?" "The graduating class goes off to the front to kill Israeli soldiers occupying the buffer zone in Lebanon. And a freshman class turns up to start a new cycle of training."
"How many instructors and staff are in the camp?"
"Including transportation people, including the experts on small arms and martial arts, including Dr. Al-Karim's personal bodyguards, 4 that I've seen, I'd say roughly 18 to 20.
Jamila went over the photographs again, double-checking for distances between buildings, the location of the gate and the perimeter fence, identifying the footpaths that crisscrossed the village and the Hezbollah camp. She produced a military map of the Bekaa to see what other forces Hezbollah might have in the general vicinity of the camp.
"When the raid begins, you must somehow get to this spot." She pointed to a well between the village and the Hezbollah camp. She handed Dante a white silk bandana, and he stuffed it into the pocket of his trousers.
"Wear this around your neck so you can be easily identified."
"How will I know when to expect the raid?"
"Exactly 6 hours before,
two Israeli M-16s will fly by at an altitude high enough to leave contrails. They'll come from north to south. When they are directly above the camp, they will make 90-degree turns to the west. Jamila slipped the photographs and map back into the folder and wedged it into the seam of the cushion. "Looks as if we've more or less covered all the essentials," Dante remarked.
"Not quite."
She stood up and began matter-of-factly stripping off her clothing. It was the first time in his life Dante had seen a woman undress when the act didn't seem sensual.
"You are supposed to be up here having sex with me. I think it would be prudent for you to be able to describe my clothing and my body."
She removed the blouse and the skirt and her underpants. "I have a small scar on the inside of my thigh, here. My pubic hair is trimmed for a bikini. I have a faded tattoo of a night moth under my right breast. And on my left arm you will see the scars of a smallpox vaccination that didn't prevent me from getting smallpox, which accounts for the pock marks on my face. When we came up here, I locked the door and you put $50, two 20s and a 10, on the desk and weighed them down with the shell casing that's on the floor over there. We both took off our clothing. You asked me to suck you, that was the expression you used, but I said I don't do that. You stripped and sat down on the couch, and I gave you a hand job, and when you were erect, I slipped on a condom and came on top of you. Please make note of the fact that I make love with my shoes on." She began to dress again. "Now it's your turn to strip, Irish, so that I can describe your body if I need to. Why do you hesitate? You are a professional. This is a matter of tradecraft." Dante shrugged and stood up and lowered his trousers. "As you can see, like most American males, even those of us who are lapsed Catholics, I am circumcised."
"And well endowed, as they say. Do you have any scars? Physical or mental?"
She didn't think he was humorous.
"I do not psychoanalyze my clients. I only fuck them."
"No scars," he said dryly. She inspected his body from foot to head and his clothing, then gestured for him to turn around.
"You can put your clothes back on," she finally said. She walked him to the door.
"You are in a dangerous business, Irish."
"I am addicted to fear," he murmured. "I require a daily fix."
"I do not believe you." "If you did not believe in something, you would not be here." She offered her hand.
"I admire your courage."
He gripped her hand and held it for a moment. "And I am dazzled by yours. An Arab who risks..." She tugged her hand free.
"I am not an Arab," she said fiercely. "I am a Lebanese Alawite."
"And what the hell is an Alawite?"
"We're a sliver of people lost in a sea of Arab Muslims who consider us heretics and detest us. We had a state once. It was under the French mandate when the Ottoman Empire broke up after the First World War. The Alawite state was called Latakia. My grandfather was a minister in the government. In 1937, against our will, Latakia became part of Syria. My grandfather was assassinated for opposing this. These days, most of the Lebanese Alawites side with the Christians against the Muslims in the civil war. Our goal is to crush the Muslims, and this includes Hezbollah, in the hope of returning Lebanon to Christian rule. Our dream is to re-establish an Alawite state, a new Latakia on the Levantine shore washed by the Mediterranean."
"I wish you good luck," Dante said with elaborate formality.
"What is it that Alawites believe that Muslims don't?"
"Now is not the moment for such discussions."
"You are a professional. This is a matter of tradecraft. I might be asked what we talked about after we had sex."
Jamila almost smiled.
"It is our belief that the Milky Way is made up of the deified souls of Alawites who rose to heaven."
"For the rest of my life I shall think of you when I look at the Milky Way," he announced. She unlocked the door and stepped aside.
"In another incarnation," she remarked solemnly, "it would have been agreeable to make love with you."
"Maybe when this is all over." This time Jamila did smile.
"All this," she said bitterly, "will never be over."
2 days after his return from Beirut, Dante was squatting in the dirt at the bottom of the quarry, demonstrating to his 19 apprentice bombers how to fill the body cavity of a dead dog with PETN, when there was a commotion at the gate of the perimeter fence above them. Several of Dr. Al-Karim's personal guards were tugging aside the razor wire. Horns blaring, two cars and a pickup truck roared into the camp and pulled up in a swirl of dust. As the dust settled, gunmen wearing the distinctive checkered Hezbollah keffiyeh could be seen dragging someone wearing loose-fitting striped pajamas and a hood over the head from the second car. Women from the village emerged from their homes and began filling the air with ululations of triumph. Lifting the hem of his burnous, Abdullah trotted up the path until he was within earshot of the gunmen who had stayed behind to guard the vehicles, and called out to them. One shouted an answer to his question and fired a clip from his Kalashnikov into the air. Abdullah turned back toward the quarry and, cupping his hands around his mouth, yelled, "God is great! They have captured an Israeli spy!" The apprentice bombers started talking excitedly among themselves. Dante, suddenly edgy, barked at them to pay attention to the demonstration. The students reacted to the tone of his voice even before Abdullah, scampering back down to the group, translated the words. Dante, wearing a surgical glove on his right hand, finished pulling the intestines through the slit he'd made in the dog's stomach and began stuffing the packets of PETN wrapped in burlap and then the radio-controlled detonator into the cavity. Using a thick needle and a length of butcher's cord, he sewed up the slit with large stitches. Standing, peeling off the surgical glove, he addressed Abdullah. "Tell them to position the dead dog so that its stomach is facing away from the enemy when he approaches." One of the students raised his hand. Abdullah translated the question. "He says you, is a dead dog more suitable than the papier-mâché rocks we learned to plant at the side of the road?" "Tell him the Greeks couldn't have used the Trojan horse trick twice," Dante said. "Tell him the same goes for the Israelis. They'll catch on very quickly to the fake rocks stuffed with explosives. So you need to invent other ruses. A dead dog lying in the middle of a road is so common that the Israeli jeeps will keep going. At which point?" Dr. Al-Karim appeared above them on the rim of the quarry. He raised a bullhorn and called, "Mr. Pippin, I would like a word with you, if you please." Dante saluted lazily and started to climb the path. Halfway to the top, he looked up and noticed that several of the Hezbollah gunmen had joined the imam. All of them had pulled their checkered keffiyehs over their faces, so that only their eyes were visible. Out of breath, Dante reached the top and approached Dr. Al-Karim. Two of the gunmen slammed bullets into the chambers of their Kalashnikovs. The metallic sound caused Dante to stop in his tracks. He forced a light laugh through his lips. "Your warriors seem jittery today," he remarked. "What's going on?" Without answering, Dr. Al-Karim turned and stalked off toward his house. Two of the gunmen prodded Dante with the barrels of their rifles. He bristled. "You want me to follow him, all you have to do is ask, politely." He trailed after the imam to the large house next to the mosque. When he reached the back of the house, he found the door to Dr. Al-Karim's office ajar. One of the gunmen behind him gestured with his Kalashnikov. Shrugging, Dante kicked open the door with his toe and went in. Time seemed to have stopped inside the room. Dr. Al-Karim, his corpulent body frozen in the seat behind the desk, his eyes hardly blinking, stared at the Israeli spy, bound with strips of white masking tape to a straight-backed kitchen chair set in the middle of the floor. Muffled groans came from the prisoner's mouth under the black hood. Dante noticed the thinness of the prisoner's wrists and ankles, and jumped to the conclusion that Hezbollah had arrested a teenage boy. The imam motioned for Dante to sit in the other straight-backed chair. Four of the gunmen took up positions along the wall behind him. "Where did we leave off our last conversation?" Dr. Al-Karim inquired stiffly. "We were talking about the Greeks and Aristotle. You were condemning them for teaching that reason gives access to truth as opposed to faith." "Precisely. We know what we know because of our faith in Allah and his prophet, who guide us to the right way, the only way. It may be seen as a transgression when a lapsed Catholic like you does not accept this. Normally, a believer such as myself should attempt to convert you, or, failing at that, expel you." He glanced at the spy. "When a Muslim turns his, or her, back on faith, it is a mortal sin, punishable by execution." The imam muttered an order in Arabic. One of the gunmen came up behind the Israeli spy and tugged off the hood. Dante caught his breath. Patches of Jamila's long dark hair were pasted to her scalp with dried blood. One of her eyes was swollen shut, her lips were badly cut, several of her front teeth were missing. A large hoop earring dangled from one lobe. The skin on the other lobe hung loose,
the result of having had the earring wrenched off without first undoing it.
"You do not deny that you know her?" Dr. Al-Karim said.
Dante had trouble speaking.
"I knew her in the carnal sense of the word," he finally replied, his voice barely audible.
"Her name is Jamila. She's the prostitute who worked the licensed tabernacle I visited in Beirut. She carted me off upstairs to what the Irish call the intensive care unit."
"Jamila is a pseudonym. She claims she cannot remember her real name, but she is obviously lying. She is protecting members of her family against retribution. She was passing herself off as a prostitute in order to spy for the Jews. Aerial photographs of several training camps, ours included, were discovered hidden in the room she used. Some of the photographs had notations, in English, describing the camp layout. We suspect you may have provided her with these notations when you visited the bar in Beirut."
A rasp of a whisper came from Jamila's cracked lips. She spoke slowly, struggling to pronounce certain consonants with her mouth open.
"I told the ones who questioned me, the Irishman was a client."
"Who then made the notations on the photographs?" demanded the imam.
"The notations were on the photographs when they were delivered to me."
Dr. Al-Karim nodded once. The gunman behind Jamila slipped two fingers through the hoop of the remaining earring and pulled down hard on it. It severed the skin on the lobe and came free in a spurt of blood. Jamila opened her mouth to scream, but passed out before the sound could emerge from her throat. A pitcher of water was flung in her face. Her eyes twitched open, and the muted scream lodged at the back of her throat like a fishbone exploded with savage force. Dante winced and turned away. Dr. Al-Karim came around the desk and planted himself in front of Dante.
"Who are you?" he demanded in a low growl.
"Pippin, Dante, freelance, free-minded, free-spirited explosive expert of Irish origin, at your beck and call as long as you keep depositing checks in my offshore account." The imam circled the prisoner, looking at her but talking to Dante.
"I would like to believe you are who you say, for your sake, for mine as well."
"Come on now, she must have seen dozens, perhaps hundreds of men in the room over the bar. Any one of them could have been her contact."
"Were you intimate with her?"
"Yes."
"Does she have any distinguishing marks on her body?"
Dante described the small scar on the inside of her thigh, the trimmed pubic hair, the vaccination scar on her left arm. Or was it her right? He wasn't sure. "Ah, yes, there was also the faded tattoo of a night moth under her right breast." Dr. Al-Karim turned to the prisoner and, gripping the loose-fitting shirt at the buttons, ripped it away from her body. He gazed at the faded tattoo under her breast, then flung the shirt closed, tucking the loose fabric under the strips of white masking tape.
"How much did you pay her?" the imam asked.
Dante thought a moment.
$50. What denomination bills?
$2.20 and $10.
You handed her $2.20 and $10?
Dante shook his head.
"I put the bills on the desk. I weighed them down with a shell casing." "What was she wearing when you had sex with her?"
"Her shoes."
"What were you wearing?"
"A condom." The imam returned to the chair behind the desk.
"Consider yourself under house arrest," he informed Dante. "Clearly you are an expert in explosives, but I fear you may be working for someone other than Hezbollah. We will re-examine your curriculum vitae with a fine-toothed comb. We will send someone to Castletown Bear on the Bera Peninsula. We will start with Mary McCullough and the restaurant called The Bank and follow the trail from there. If you have lied about a single detail..."
He didn't bother to finish the sentence. As Dante rose to his feet, a deep groan escaped from the prisoner. Everyone in the room turned to look at her. Her mouth agape, Jamila hyperventilated and angled her head and, gasping for breath, fixed her one open eye on Dante. With some effort, she managed to spit out,
"You are one lousy lover, Irish."
And then she smiled a crooked smile and gagged on the mordant laughter seeping up from the back of her throat. Back in his low room, with armed guards posted at the door, Dante sprawled on his cot and stared at the whitewashed ceiling, wondering if the stains of the crushed flies might convey bulletins from the front. And he recreated her voice in his skull,
He could make out the words, forced with great effort through her bruised lips. "You are one lousy lover, Irish." At sunset, Abdullah turned up at the door of his room. His manner had changed. It was written in his eyes that he no longer thought of Dante as a comrade in arms. "You are instructed to come with me," he announced, and without waiting he turned and quit the room. Two gunmen, with their kafirs masking their faces and only their eyes visible, fell in behind Dante as he followed Abdullah through the village to the Hezbollah camp's perimeter fence. The gate in the fence had been dragged back, and Abdullah signaled for Dante to follow him through it to the rim of the quarry. The 19 apprentice bombers, along with the permanent staff and the Hezbollah gunmen who had brought the prisoner from Beirut, were lined up along the rim. Across the quarry, her back to the setting sun, Jamila was being bound to a signpost by two of the gunmen. One of them hung a small khaki army satchel around her neck, then reached inside it to manipulate the wires and complete the electrical circuit. Jamila's knees buckled under her, and she collapsed into the ropes holding her to the post. As the gunman left her side, the satchel dangled from its straps against her chest. Dr. Al-Karim materialized alongside Dante. He was holding a small remote transmitter, which he offered to Dante.
"Would you like the honor?"
Dante looked down at the transmitter.
"She is not my enemy," he said.
High above the Bekaa Rift, two Israeli jets, flying soundlessly, their contrails catching the last smudges of sunlight, appeared from the north. When they were directly over the Hezbollah camp, they banked 90 degrees to the west. As they headed toward the sea, the sound of their engines engulfed the camp. The imam gazed across the quarry at the woman tied to the signpost. Then, in an abrupt gesture, he raised the transmitter and rotated the switch until there was a hollow click, and depressed it. For an instant that stretched into an eternity, nothing happened. Dr. Al-Karim, his brows knitted, was raising the transmitter to activate it again, when, across the quarry, a dull blast stirred up a fume of mustard-colored smoke. When it dissipated, the woman had vanished, and only the stump of the post remained. Around the rim of the quarry, the Fedayeen began to wander off into the darkness that settled quickly over the Bekaa at this time of year. The imam produced the string of jade worry beads and began working them through his pudgy fingers. The gesture struck Dante as therapeutic. He noticed that Dr. Al-Karim's fingers and lips were trembling. Could it be that this was the first time he'd killed someone with his own hand?
"When a Muslim turns her back on faith," the imam murmured. He appeared to be talking to himself. "It is a mortal sin, punishable by execution."
By midnight, the cold gusts that swept down from the Golan Heights most nights of the year had picked up, drowning out the sound of the helicopters coming in high and fast and plummeting toward the ground like shot birds to land at strategic points around the Hezbollah camp. The roadblock at the spot where the Beirut highway curved uphill to the village and the camp was overrun without a shot being fired. The Fedayeen noticed that the men coming toward them were wearing kafirs and made the fatal mistake of taking them for Arabs. "Assalamu alaikum," one of the men in kafirs called out. A sentry at the roadblock called back, "Wa alaikum salam." It was the last word he uttered. In the bunker on top of the hill above the quarry, the Fedayeen started firing their heavy machine gun into the darkness when they caught sight of figures sprinting up the slope. The attackers, equipped with night vision goggles, didn't return fire until they were close enough to lob stun grenades over the bunker's sandbags. Other teams from the helicopters, their faces blackened with charcoal, raced through the village to attack the two low buildings that served as the camp's dormitory. Most of the apprentice bombers, as well as the staffers and the visiting Fedayeen, were gunned down as they tried to flee through the doors and the windows. Explosive charges planted against the small brick building blew away the Hezbollah flag on the roof and set off a string of smaller explosions as the wooden boxes filled with ammunition caught fire. Dante, crouching inside the door of his room, heard the two guards outside hollering into a walkie-talkie for instructions. When there was no response, they both raced off in the direction of the imam's house behind the mosque, only to be killed by one of the Israeli teams blocking the narrow streets. The first casualties for the raiders came when several of them burst through the back door into Dr. Al-Karim's office. One of the imam's personal guards walked toward them with his hands raised over his head and then blew himself up, killing two of the attackers and wounding two more. The other raiders, streaming through doors and windows, stormed through the house, killing the bodyguards and servants and one of the imam's wives and two of his teenage sons as they dashed from room to room. They found Dr. Al-Karim hiding in an armoire on the top floor as his second wife and two other children cowered in a nearby bathroom fitted with gold-plated faucets on the sink and the bathtub. The imam was handcuffed and blindfolded and hauled through the streets toward one of the waiting helicopters. When the sound of gunfire subsided, Dante knotted Jamila's white silk bandana around his neck and darted from the house in the direction of the water well between the village and the Hezbollah camp. Turning the corner of a narrow street, he was suddenly caught in a crossfire between some fedayeen who had taken cover on the ground floor of the school and the attackers crouching behind a low wall across the street. Dante dove behind a pickup truck as the fedayeen started firing rifle grenades. One of them exploded next to the pickup, and Dante felt the tingling prick of hot shrapnel in his lower back. The sound of gunfire seemed to grow more distant as he lay on the road, staring up at the dull white stain stretching across the night sky, while he waited for the pain that always trailed after the tearing of skin. Slightly delirious, he was trying to focus on the Milky Way in order to identify the star that represented the deified soul of the Alawite prostitute, Jamila, when it finally arrived. A searing stitch of pain shot up his spinal column, and he blacked out. Dante woke to the blinding whiteness of a hospital room. Sunlight streamed through two windows, and he felt its warmth on his shoulders above the bandages. He turned his head away from the sunlight and discovered Crystal Quest sitting on the next bed, munching crushed ice as she worked on a crossword puzzle. Benny Sapir, the Mossad spymaster who had briefed him in Washington, watched from the foot of the bed.
"Where the hell am I, Fred?" Dante asked weakly. "He's come back to life," Benny observed. "About time," Quest growled. She didn't want Dante to take her presence there as a manifestation of softness. "I have other things to do in life besides holding his hand. Hey, Dante, being Irish, you ought to know this one. Joyce's Silence, Exile, and Seven Letters starts with a C."
"Cunning." That was Stephen Dedalus' strategy for survival in Portrait of an Artist.
Cunning! Ha! It fits perfectly. Fred peered over the top of the newspaper, her bloodshot eyes focusing on the wounded agent. You're in Haifa, Dante, in an Israeli hospital. The doctors had to pry some metal out of your lower back. The bad news is you'll wind up with a disagreeable cavity and a gimpy left leg, the result of a compressed nerve. The good news is there will be no major infirmities, and you'll be able to tuck a pistol behind your back without it producing a bulge in your clothing.
Did you capture the imam?
We collared the guy who was masquerading as an imam. A direct descendant of the prophet, my ass. I suppose it won't hurt if you fill him in, she told Benny. Izzat al-Karim was a pseudonym. Your imam's real name was Aoun Kikodze. He was the only son of an Afghan father and his third wife, a teenage Kazakh girl who won a local beauty contest in Alma-Ata. Kikodze studied dentistry in Alma-Ata and was working as a dentist's assistant there in the early 1980s when he made Hijra to Mecca, where he was discovered by Iranian talent scouts and recruited into Hezbollah. We first noticed him when he opened a mosque above a warehouse in southern Lebanon and began preaching some malarkey about the near enemy and the far enemy. Nobody could make heads or tails out of what he was saying, but it came across like the Islamic version of what you Americans call fire and brimstone, and he made a name for himself. Next thing you know, he was sporting the black turban of a Sayyid and running a Hezbollah training base. Even as we speak, my colleagues are trying to talk him into helping them with their inquiries into Hezbollah activities in the Bekaa.
I suppose they'll succeed, Fred said. The Israelis are at war, Dante, so they don't have weak-kneed civil libertarians breathing down their necks the way we do. If he's still compos mentis when they finish with him, we get to get sloppy seconds. Dante turned on Benny.
Why didn't you tell me all this when you briefed me in Washington?
If you'd been caught, you'd have talked. We didn't want the putative imam to know we knew he was putative.
Yeah, well, we lost Jamila, Dante said bitterly.
Crystal Quest slid off the bed and approached Dante. The Levant is full of girls named Jamila. Which one are you talking about?
The Jamila in Beirut, for God's sake. The Alawite who was posing as a prostitute. They executed her 6 hours before the helicopters arrived. I'll lay odds you won't want to hear how.
Fred snorted.
Oh, that Jamila. Jesus, Dante, for someone in your line of work, you can be awfully naive. Jamila was a legend. Her real name was Zubida. She wasn't posing as a prostitute. She was working as a prostitute in Dubai when she was recruited. And she wasn't an Alawite, she was an Iraqi Sunni. Thanks to some fancy footwork on our part, she believed she would be working for Saddam Hussein's Mukhabarat. There was an elegant logic to this false flag pitch, if I do say so myself. Saddam detests the Shiites and their Iranian mentors, and by extension, he loathes Hezbollah, which is a Shiite client of the Iranian mullahs. Dante could hear Jamila's voice in his ear.
You are one lousy lover, Irish. Whoever she tried to save me when she could have used what she knew to save herself.
He noticed the square of white silk hanging from a hook on the back of the door.
Do me a favor. Bring me the bandana, Fred.
Crystal Quest retrieved the square of silk and folded it into Dante's hand.
It's a hell of a memento, Benny said from the end of the bed. You owe your life to that bandana. When you didn't turn up at the well, our raiding party decided to write you off.
One of the teams taking a last look around the camp reported seeing a man lying next to a pickup wearing a white bandana. It saved your life.
My Dante Pippin cover must be blown.
That's the least of our problems, Fred said with a titter. One thing we have an endless supply of in Langley is legends. We'll work up a brand new one for you when you're back on your feet.
Benny said, thanks to you, Dante, the operation was a great success.
It was a crying shame, Dante said with sudden vehemence, and he meant it literally.
1997. Martin Odom discovers that Seamus is a Yiddish word. Lulled by the drone of the jet engines, Martin, his right leg jutting into the aisle, his left knee jammed into the back of the seat in front of him, had dozed off halfway through the flight and had missed the sight of the coastal shoal of Israel unrolling like a fulgent carpet under the wing of the plane. The wheels grinding out of their bays woke him with a start. He glanced at Stella, who was sound asleep in the seat next to him. He touched her shoulder. "We're almost there." She nodded gloomily. The closer she got to Israel, the less sure she was about tracking down her sister's runaway husband. What if she caught up with him? What then? As a matter of simple tradecraft, they had come to Israel using different routes. She had taken a flight to London and gone by train to Paris and then flown on to Athens to catch the 2 a.m. flight to Tel Aviv. He had flown New York-Rome and spent several hours getting lost in crowds around the Colosseum before boarding a train to Venice and an overnight car ferry to Patras, where he caught a bus to Athens airport and then the plane to Israel. Martin, queuing after Stella, had winked at the woman behind the counter and asked for a seat next to the good-looking girl who had just checked in.
"Do you know her?" the woman had asked.
"No, but I'd like to," he'd replied.
The woman had laughed. "You guys never give up, do you?"
Landing at Ben-Gurion Airport in a light drizzle, the plane taxied to the holding area, and the captain, speaking English over the intercom, ordered the passengers to remain seated for security reasons. Two lean young men, their shirt tails hanging loose to hide the handguns tucked into their belts, strolled down the aisle, checking identity photos in passports against faces. One of the young men, wearing opaque sunglasses, reached Martin's row.
"Passports," he snapped.
Stella produced hers from the side pocket of a handbag under the seat. Martin pulled his from the breast pocket inside his vest and handed both of them to the security agent. He riffled through the pages with his thumb. Returning to the page with Martin's photograph, he looked over the top of the passport at Martin.
"Are you traveling together?"
They both said no at the same time. The young man pocketed the two passports. "Come with me," he ordered. He stepped aside so that Martin could retrieve his valise from the overhead rack. Then he shepherded Stella and Martin down the aisle ahead of him. The other passengers gaped at the man and woman being hustled from the plane, trying to figure out whether they were celebrities or terrorists. An olive-green Suzuki with a thick plastic partition between the front and rear seats was waiting on the damp tarmac at the bottom of the portable stairs, and Martin and Stella were motioned into the back seat. Martin could hear the locks in the back doors click shut as he settled down for what turned out to be a short ride. Stella started to say something, but he cut her off with a twitch of his finger, indicating that the automobile could be bugged. Seeing her nervousness, he offered her a smile of encouragement. The first shadows of first light were starting to graze the tarmac and fields to the east of the airport as the car made its way to a distant hangar on the far side of the main runway and parked next to a metal staircase that led to a green door high in the hangar. The locks on the back doors of the Suzuki clicked open, and the driver pointed indolently with his chin toward the staircase.
"I suppose they mean for us to go up there," Stella ventured.
"Uh-huh," Martin agreed. Favoring his game leg, he led the way up the long flight of steps. At the top, he tugged open the heavy gunmetal door and, holding it open for Stella, followed her into an immense loft with a remarkably low ceiling. Sitting at desks scattered around the loft were 20 or so people working at computer terminals. Despite the positively no admittance sign on the outside of the door, none of them looked up when the two visitors appeared. Female soldiers in khaki shirts and khaki miniskirts steered carts through the room, picking up and distributing computer disks. A man with a gray crew cut appeared from behind a heavy curtain that served to partition off a corner of the loft. He was dressed in a suit and tie, rare for an Israeli, and wore a government-issue smile on his very tanned face.
"Look what the cat dragged in, if it isn't Dante Pippin in the flesh."
"Didn't know that Shabak Mandarins got up before the sun," Martin ventured.
The smile vanished from the Israeli's face.
"Shabak Mandarins never sleep, Dante. That's something you used to know."
He glanced at Stella, who was peeling away the rubber bands on the braid dangling down her spine so that her hair, damp from the light rain, would dry out without curling.
"Step out of character," the Shabak Mandarin said to Martin, all the while taking in his companion's thin figure in tailored trousers and running shoes. "Be a gentleman and introduce us."
"His name used to be Asher," Martin informed Stella. "Chances are he's recycled himself by now. When our paths crossed, he was a gumshoe for the Shabak, which is short for Sherut HaBitachon HaKalali. Is my pronunciation in the ballpark, Asher? The Shabak is the nearest thing Israel has to an FBI.
Martin grinned at the Israeli.
"I haven't the foggiest idea who she is."
The Israeli spread his hands wide.
"I didn't come down with the first snowfall, Dante."
"If your people pulled her off the plane, it means you know who she is. Come clean, Asher. Who tipped you off?"
"A little canary."
Asher pulled back a corner of the curtain and ushered his visitors into the area that served as an office. He gestured toward a couch and settled onto a high stool facing them.
"Could that little canary of yours be a female of the species called Fred?" Martin inquired.
"How can a female be named Fred?"
Asher asked innocently.
"Fred is Crystal Quest, the honcho of the CIA's Dirty Tricks Department."
"Is that her real name, Dante? We know the CIA's deputy director of operations by another name."
Stella looked at Martin.
"Why does he keep calling you Dante?"
Asher answered for him.
"When your traveling companion did us a favor 8 years ago, Dante Pippin was his working legend. He disappeared from our radar screen before we had a chance to learn his real identity. So you can imagine our surprise when we discovered that Dante Pippin would be on the Olympus flight from Athens, traveling under the name of Martin Odom. Is Martin Odom the real you, or just another one of your legends?"
"Not sure, actually."
"Yes, well, people like you shouldn't breeze into Israel without touching base with the Shabak. The way I see it, it's a matter of professional courtesy. This is especially true when you're traveling with a former member of the KGB.
Martin melted back into the couch, his eyes fixed on Stella.
"The Israelis don't get details like that wrong," he said quietly. "Next thing you know, you'll be telling me Stella isn't your real name."
"I can explain," she said.
One of the girl soldiers, wearing a particularly short khaki miniskirt, backed past the curtain carrying a tray with a pot of hot tea and two mugs. She set it down on the table. Asher mumbled something to her in Hebrew. Glancing at the two visitors over her shoulder as she left, the girl snickered appreciatively.
"If you can explain, explain," Asher told Stella.
He filled the two mugs and slid them across the table toward his visitors. Martin asked Stella,
"What did you do for the KGB?
"I wasn't a spy or anything like that," she told him.
"Kastner was the deputy head of the 6th Chief Directorate before he defected. The directorate's main line of work was dealing with economic crimes, but it wound up housing sections that didn't have a home in any of the other directorates. The Forgers, for instance, worked out of the 6th Chief Directorate, and their budget was buried in the directorate's overall budget.
The same was true for the section that drew up blueprints for weapons the Soviet Union had no intention of developing, and then let the plans fall into the hands of the Americans in the hope of making them waste their resources keeping up with us. I was teaching English to grade school children when Kastner proposed a job in a section that was so secret, only a handful of party people outside the Kremlin knew of its existence. Its in-house name was Subsection Marx, but it was named after Groucho, not Karl. At any given time, there were 24 men sitting around a long table, clipping stories from newspapers and magazines and inventing anti-Soviet jokes.
Disbelief was written all over Asher's face. I've heard some tall tales in my life, but this beats them all. Let her finish.
Stella plunged on. The KGB thought of the Soviet Union as a pressure cooker, the subsection Marx as the little metal cap that you occasionally lifted to let off steam. I and some other young women would come in on Fridays and memorize the jokes that the subsection had produced during the week. We were on an expense account. Over the weekend, we'd go out to restaurants or Komsomol clubs or workers' canteens or poetry readings and repeat the jokes. They did a study once. They found that a good joke that started out in Moscow could reach the Kamchatka Peninsula on the Pacific coast in 36 hours.
Give us some examples of the jokes you spread, Asher, still dubious, ordered.
Stella closed her eyes and thought for a moment. When there were demonstrations in Poland against the stationing of Soviet troops there, I helped spread the story of the Polish boy who runs into a Warsaw police station and cries, "Quick, quick, you have to help me. Two Swiss soldiers stole my Russian watch." The policeman looks puzzled and says, "You mean two Russian soldiers stole your Swiss watch?" And the boy says, "That's right, but you said it, not me."
When neither Martin nor Asher laughed, Stella said,
"It was considered very humorous in its day."
"Do you remember another?" Martin asked.
"One of our most successful jokes was the one about two Communist Party apparatchiks meeting on a Moscow street. One of them says to the other, 'Have you heard the latest? Our Soviet scientists have managed to miniaturize nuclear warheads. Now we no longer need those expensive intercontinental ballistic missiles to wipe out America. We can put the nuclear warhead into a valise and put the valise in a locker at Grand Central Station in New York City. And if the Americans give us any trouble, pfft, New York will be reduced to radioactive ashes.' The second Russian replies, 'Nevozmoshno. It's not possible. Where in Russia will we find a valise?'"
Stella's joke reminded Martin of a fragment from a previous legend, Lincoln Dittman's conversation at a terrorist training camp in Triple Border with the Saudi who was interested in obtaining a Soviet nuclear valise bomb. Somehow Stella's little joke didn't seem like a laughing matter. Asher obviously agreed because he was gnawing on the inside of a cheek in irritation. Stella, exasperated, repeated,
"Where in Russia will you find a valise? That's the punchline of a joke, for God's sake. Is it against Israeli law to laugh?"
Asher, like his colleagues in the CIA and the KGB, lost laughter a long time ago, Martin said. They're time servers, hanging on by their fingertips to a world they no longer understand. If they can hang on long enough, they'll get a government pension and end their days growing stringless green beans in some suburban backyard. The reigning emotion here is nostalgia. On the rare occasions they loosen up, they start all their sentences with, "Remember the time we..." Isn't that right, Asher? Asher appeared to wince at Martin's little speech. "Okay," he said, turning to Stella. "For the moment, let's agree that you worked for Subsection Marx, spreading lousy anti-Soviet jokes so the country could let off steam. Whatever brings you and Dante to the Holy Land, it's not to tell jokes."
"Tourism,"
Martin said flatly.
"Absolutely. Tourism,"
Stella agreed emphatically. She reached for the mug of tea and dipped a pinky in it and carefully moistened her lips with the ball of her finger.
"We came to see the Temple Mount. We came to see Masada on the Dead Sea. We came to see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre."
Her voice trailed off. "Are you planning to visit your sister in her West Bank settlement at some point?" Stella glanced at Martin, then turned back to Asher.
"That also, naturally."
"And Dante is keeping you company in exactly what capacity?" Stella raised her chin.
"I know him by the name of Martin. He is my lover."
The Israeli eyed Martin. "I suppose you could describe her body if you had to."
"No problem, up to and including the faded tattoo of a Siberian night moth under her right breast."
Out of the corner of his eye, Martin saw Stella start to undo the top buttons of her shirt. Once again, there was no sign of an undergarment, only a triangle of pale skin. Asher, embarrassed, cleared his throat.
That won't be necessary, Miss Kastner. I have reason to believe Dante works as a private detective and you hired his services. What you do after working hours is your business.
Asher regarded Martin.
So that's what spies turn into when they come in from the cold. They metamorphose into private detectives. Sure beats cultivating stringless green beans. Tell me something, Dante. How does one go about becoming a private detective?
You watch old detective films.
He's a great fan of Humphrey Bogart, Stella asserted, avoiding Martin's eye.
Asher watched her sip at the tea for a moment. When he spoke again, his mood had changed. To Martin, he suddenly looked more like an undertaker than a cop.
Let me offer you some sympathy with your tea, Miss Kastner, Asher began.
He slid off the stool and walked over to a table and flipped open the top dossier on a thick pile of dossiers.
I am sorry to be the bearer of sad news, he said, and he read from the page. The following is a State Department advisory forwarded by the American Embassy in Tel Aviv. Please pass this information to Estelle Kastner. Her father, Oscar Alexandrovich Kastner, suffered a heart attack at his home in Brooklyn 5 days ago.
Stella's eyes tightened into an anguished squint.
Oh, my God, I've got to telephone Kastner immediately, she whispered.
Martin could tell from the dark expression on Asher's face that there was no point in putting in a phone call.
He's dead, isn't he?
I'm afraid Dante's right, Asher told Stella. His gaze fell on Martin.
There's something the little canary wanted me to pass on to you, Dante. The body of a Chinese girl was discovered on the roof over your pool parlor. Her boss at a Chinese restaurant went looking for her when she didn't turn up for work. She'd been stung to death by bees from one of your hives. Hell of a way to go, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, Martin agreed grimly. I would say.
Neither Martin nor Stella said a word in the communal taxi for fear the driver or one of the other passengers might be working for the Shabak. Both worried also that emotions would get the upper hand if one of them broke the comforting silence. 15 minutes after leaving the airport, they found themselves standing on a street corner in downtown Jerusalem. Heavy morning traffic flowed around them. Squads of soldiers, some of them dark-skinned Ethiopians wearing green flak jackets and green berets, patrolled the streets, checking the identity papers of anyone who looked remotely Arab. Martin let 6 taxis pass before hailing the 7th. They took it to the American Colony Hotel in East Jerusalem, where a line of Palestinian taxis queued on the street outside the hotel. A young Russian, in Israel for a chess tournament, was leaning over a chessboard set up on the hood of a car parked outside the hotel entrance, as a television camera filmed him. He was playing against himself, slamming the pieces down on the board as he made a 12 rapid moves, muttering all the while about a flaw in Black's position or the ineptness of White's attack. Spotting an opening, he gleefully thrust the white pieces forward for the kill, then looked up and announced in English that Black had resigned in the face of White's dazzling attack.
How can he play against himself and remain sane? Stella asked.
The advantage of playing against yourself is, unlike real life, you know what your opponent's next move will be, Martin observed. He waited until the first 3 Palestinian taxis had driven off with passengers before signaling to the 4th.
Mustafa at your beck and call, announced the young Palestinian driver as he loaded their valises into the back of a yellow Mercedes that, judging from its appearance, had been around longer than the driver.
So to where?
Kiryat Arba, Stella said. The enthusiasm drained from Mustafa's eyes.
It will cost you 40 shekels or $10 US, he said. I only take you to the main gate. The Jews will not tolerate Arab taxis inside.
The main gate will be fine, Martin said as he and Stella settled onto the cracking leather of the back seat. Mustafa's plastic worry beads dangling from the rearview mirror tapped against the windshield as the taxi sped past fortress-like Israeli neighborhoods and bus stops swarming with religious Jews and headed away from Jerusalem on a new highway that knifed south into the Judean hills. On the rocky slopes on either side of the highway, knots of Palestinian men walked along dirt paths to avoid the Israeli checkpoints as they made their way into Jewish Jerusalem in the hope of finding a day's work.
In the wadis, boys who had climbed onto the high branches of trees could be seen picking olives and stuffing them under their open shirts.
"You were tempting fate back at the airport," Martin remarked. "I'm talking about when you started to unbutton your shirt to show Asher the night moth under your breast. What would you have done if he hadn't stopped you?"
Stella inched closer to Martin until her thigh was touching his. She badly wanted to be comforted.
"I consider myself a pretty good judge of character," she replied. "My instinct told me he would stop me, or at the very least avert his eyes."
"What about me?" Martin asked. "Did you think I'd avert my eyes?"
Stella stared through the grime on the window, remembering how she had clung to Kastner when she had hugged him goodbye. He had wheeled his chair away abruptly, but she had still caught sight of the tears welling in his eyes. She turned to Martin.
"Sorry, I was somewhere else. What did you say?"
"I asked whether you thought I'd avert my eyes, too, if you started to show Asher the night moth supposedly tattooed under your breast."
"Not sure," she admitted. "Haven't figured you out yet."
"What's to figure out?"
"There are parts of you that my instinct can't get to. The heart of the matter is hidden under too many moods. It's almost as if you were several different people. For one thing, I can't decide if you are interested in women. I can't decide if you want to seduce me or not. Females need to get this detail right before they can have a working relationship with a man."
"Not," Martin said without hesitation. "Trouble with women in general, and you in particular, is you're incapable of being on the receiving end of courtesy without assuming seduction is behind it."
Martin thought of Min coaxing erections out of his reluctant flesh during their occasional evenings together. He wondered if her death on the roof above the pool parlor had really been an accident. "Here's the deal, Stella. I'm past seduction. When I'm backed up against a wall, I make war, not love."
"That's pain speaking," Stella whispered, thinking of her own pain. "You ought to consider the possibility that intimacy can be a painkiller."
Martin shook his head. "My experience has been that you become intimate in order to have sex. Once the sex is out of the way, the intimacy only brings more pain." Moving back to her side of the seat, Stella burst out in irritation.
"It's typical of the male of the species to think you become intimate in order to have sex. The female of the species has a more subtle take on the subject. She understands that you have sex in order to become intimate, that intimacy is the ultimate orgasm, since it allows you to get outside of the prison of yourself, get outside your skin and into the skin, the psyche of another human being. Sex that leads to intimacy is a jailbreak."
Mustafa slowed for an Israeli checkpoint, but was waved through when two soldiers peered through the back window and mistook the passengers for Jews heading back to one of the settlements. The taxi sped past roadside carts brimming with oranges and zucchinis, and restaurants with kebab roasting on spits, and garages with cars up on cinder blocks and mechanics sprawled flat on their backs underneath them. It slowed again for a flock of sheep that scattered when Mustafa leaned on the horn. Young Arab women with babies strapped to their backs by a shawl, older women in long robes with heavy bundles balanced on their heads, trudged along the side of the road, turning their faces away to avoid the dust kicked up by the Mercedes barreling past. Half an hour out of Jerusalem, the taxi eased to a stop outside Kiryat Arba next to a sign that read, "Zionist Settlement. The more they torture him, the more he will become." Martin could see the two guards at the gate in the security fence watching them suspiciously. Both were armed with Uzis, with the ritual tzitzit jutting out from under their bulletproof vests. While Stella retrieved the two valises from the trunk of the Mercedes, Martin walked around to the open passenger window to pay Mustafa. From one of the minarets below, the recorded wail of the muezzin summoning the faithful to midday prayer drifted up to the Jewish settlement. Slipping a $10 bill through the window, Martin noticed that the framed license on the glove compartment had a photograph of Mustafa, but identified him, in English, as Azam Kuri.
"Why did you tell me your name was Mustafa?" he asked the driver.
"Mustafa, he was my brother, killed by the Israeli army during the Intifada. We was both of us throwing stones at the Jewish tanks, and they got mad and started throwing bullets back. Since, my mother calls me Mustafa to pretend my brother is still being alive. Some days I call myself Mustafa for the same reason. Some days I'm not sure who I am. Today is such a day."
The guards at the gate scrutinized the passports of the visitors.
When Stella explained that she was there to see her sister, Yara Ugorzhilov, they phoned up to the settlement, a cluster of blockhouse-like concrete apartment buildings spilling like lava down the side of a once barren hill toward the Arab city of Hebron. Minutes later, a battered pickup appeared at the top of the hill and slowly made its way, its spark plugs misfiring, past the playground teeming with mothers and little children, to the gate. A moment later, Stella and her sister were clinging to each other. Martin could see Stella talking quietly into the ear of her sister. Yelena, or Yara as she was now called, took a step back, shook her head vehemently, then burst into tears and fell back into her sister's arms. The driver of the pickup, a stocky, bearded man in his 50s, wearing black sneakers, a black suit and a black tie and black fedora, approached Martin. He inspected him through windowpane-thick bifocals set into wire frames.
"Shalom to you, Mr. Martin Odom," he said with a distinct Brooklyn accent. "I'm Rabbi Ben Zion. You need to be Stella's detective friend. I'm right, right?"
"Right on both counts," Martin said. "I'm a detective and I'm a friend."
"It's me, the rabbi who married Yara to Samat," Ben Zion announced. "If you're trying to track down Samat and get poor Yara a religious divorce, I'll give you the time of day. If not, not."
"How'd you know I was a detective, or about my tracking down Samat?"
"A little canary told someone in the Shabak, and that someone told yours truly, the two tourists who weren't touring anything but Kiryat Arba, could be expected to wash up on our doorstep. Miracle of miracles, here you are."
The rabbi raised a hand to shield his eyes from the noon sun and sized up the Brooklyn detective who had found his way to Kiryat Arba.
"So you're not Jewish, Mr. Odom?"
Behind them, the two sisters started to walk uphill, their arms around each other's waists. Martin said, "How can you tell?" Rabbi Ben Zion tossed his head in the direction of Hebron, sprawling at their feet 2 football fields away below them.
"You don't live in the middle of a sea of Arabs without recognizing one of your own when you see him."
"In other words, it's a matter of instinct."
"Survival instinct, developed over 2,000 years.
The rabbi pitched the 2 valises into the back of the pickup.
"So be my guest and climb in," he ordered. "I'll take you to Yara's apartment. We'll get there before the girls and cook up water for tea and light a yahrzeit candle for her father. The canary told me about the death in the family, too, but I thought it would be better if Stella broke the bad news to her sister. Ask me nicely and I'll tell you what I know about the missing husband."
The rabbi threw the pickup into gear and, his side curls flying, gunned it up the hill, past the settlement post office, past the shopping center teeming with women in ankle-length skirts and small boys wearing knitted yarmulke. Yara, it turned out, lived in a small 2-room apartment on the ground floor of one of the apartment buildings with a view of Hebron.
When her husband abandoned her, she had no resources of her own, so our synagogue took her under its wing, the rabbi explained.
He searched through a ring of keys until he came to the right one and unlocked the door. The furnishings were Spartan. There was a narrow cot in one room with a cracked mirror bordered with plastic seashells over it, and a wooden crate turned upside down serving as a night table. A folding bridge table covered with a square of oilcloth, a motley assortment of folding chairs with a small black and white television set on one of them, were scattered around what served as a living room. On the sill of a waist-high bookcase separating the living room from the tiny kitchen alcove were 3 flower pots containing plastic geraniums. Martin opened the door to the small bathroom. Women's cotton underwear and several pairs of long woolen stockings hung from a cord stretched over the bathtub. Ben Zion noticed Martin's expression as he returned to the living room.
"We bought the furniture from Arabs whose houses were bulldozed between us and Hebron so we could walk to the cave of Machpelah safely."
Martin strolled over to the window and raised the shade and looked out at the tangle of streets and buildings that made up Hebron.
"What's the cave of Machpelah?" he called over his shoulder.
The rabbi was in the kitchen alcove, attempting to light the gas burner with a match to boil water in a kettle.
"Am I hearing you correctly? What's the cave of Machpelah? It's nothing less than the 2nd holiest place for Jews on the planet Earth, ranking immediately behind the Temple Mount, or what's left of it, the Wailing Wall. Hebron, which in biblical times was called Kiryat Arba, is where the patriarch Abraham settled when he first set foot in the Holy Land. The cave is where Abraham is buried. His sons Isaac and Jacob, his wife Sarah, too. It is also holy to the Palestinians, who co-opted our Abraham to be one of their prophets. They built a mosque on the spot, and we are obliged to take turns praying at the cave."
Lighting a burner, the rabbi slid the kettle over the grill. Shaking his head in disbelief, he struck another match and lit a yahrzeit candle for the dead and carried it back into the room. "What is the Cave of Machpelah?" he asked rhetorically, setting the candle on the table. "Even a shaggetz ought to know the answer to that one. We always stroll down to the cave on Fridays at sunset to welcome the Sabbath in at this holy site. You and Stella are welcome to join us. That way you can tell the Shabak you actually did some sightseeing." Martin decided there had been enough small talk. "What about Samat?" Rabbi Ben Zion covered his mouth to smother a belch. "What about Samat?" he repeated. "Did he run off with another woman?" "Let me tell you something, Mr. Brooklyn detective who thinks men only leave their wives for other ladies. Samat didn't need to quit his wife to have another lady. He rented all the ladies his libido desired. When he disappeared in his Honda for 3 days running, where do you think he went? It's an open secret where he went. He went where a lot of men go when they want ladies to do things their wives won't do. In Jaffa and Tel Aviv and Haifa, there are what my mother, may she rest in peace, used to call houses of ill repute, where you can get your ashes hauled by ladies who don't mind being naked with a man, who for a price are willing to do anything to satisfy a client." The rabbi waved a hand in the general direction of the Mediterranean coast. "Samat had sexual appetites. You could see it in his eyes. You could tell it from the way he looked at his sister-in-law Estelle when she visited Kiryat Arba. Samat also had his share of obsessions that weren't carnal. What I'm saying is, he had other axes to grind besides sex." In the kitchenette, the kettle began to shriek. The rabbi leaped to turn off the gas and set about preparing tea. He returned moments later carrying the kettle and 4 china cups, which he put on the bridge table next to the memorial candle. Leaning over the table, the better to see what he was doing, Ben Zion slipped Lipton tea bags into the 4 cups and filled the first one with boiling water. When Martin waved it away, he took the cup himself and sank onto one of the folding chairs, his knees apart, his feet flat on the floor and tapping impatiently. Martin scraped over another chair and sat down facing him. Why would someone like Samat, who needed to visit houses of ill repute to satisfy his lusts, marry a religious woman whom he had never met? Am I inside Samat's head to know the answer? The rabbi blew noisily across the cup, then touched his lips to the tea to test the temperature. Deciding it was too hot to drink, he set it down on the table. He was a strange boy, this Samat. I am Yara's rabbi. In the Jewish religion, we don't confess to our spiritual leaders the way Catholics do, but we confide in them. I believed Yara when she said that Samat never touched her on her wedding night, or after. He never slept in the marriage bed. For all I know, she may still be a virgin. When Samat was living under the same roof with her, she was absolutely convinced something was wrong with her. I tried to persuade her that the something that was wrong with him. I tried to persuade him, too.
Did you succeed? The rabbi shook his head cheerlessly. To use an old Yiddish expression, I never got to first base with Samat.
What was he doing here?
Hiding.
From what? From whom?
The rabbi tried his tea again. This time he managed to sip at it.
Well, am I a reader of minds? How would I know? From what? From whom? Look, coming to live in one of these Jewish settlements in the middle of all these Arabs is a little like joining the French Foreign Legion. When you sign on the dotted line, nobody asks to see your curriculum vitae. We're just glad to have your warm body. What I do know is that Samat went to the Kiryat Arba security officer and asked for a weapon. He said it was to protect his wife if the Hamas terrorists ever attacked.
Did he get the weapon?
The rabbi nodded. Anybody living in the settlement who can see what he's shooting at can get a weapon. Ben Zion remembered another detail.
Samat evidently had an endless supply of money. He paid for everything he bought with cash. An upscale split-level house on the side of Kiryat Arba where you get to enjoy the sunsets. A brand-new Japanese car with air conditioning. He never played pinochle with the boys. He never accompanied Yara to the synagogue, even on the high holy days, though it didn't go unnoticed that she always left an envelope stuffed with cash in the charity box.
Admit it, Mr. American Detective, I'll bet you don't know that Seamus is a Yiddish word.
I thought it was Irish.
Irish!
The rabbi slapped a palm against one of his knees.
The Shamus was the synagogue beadle, which was the sobriquet for the member of the congregation who took care of the synagogue.
Ben Zion shook his head in puzzlement.
How, I ask you, is it possible to detect an AWOL husband if you can't detect the origin of the word Shamus? The sudden arrival of Yara and Stella saved Martin from having to account for this lapse in his education. It also provided him with his first good look at Samat's wife. She was a short, overweight woman with a teenager's pudgy face and a matronly body endowed with an ample bosom that put a strain on the buttons of her blouse. Martin feared that one of them would pop at any moment. In the space between the buttons, he caught a glimpse of the pink fabric of a heavy brassiere. She wore an ankle-length skirt popular with Lubavitch women, and a round, flat-brimmed felt hat that she nervously twisted on her head as if she were trying to find the front. The little patches of skin on her body that Martin could see were chalk-white from lack of being exposed to sunlight. Her cheeks were streaked with traces of tears. Stella, dry-eyed, wore the ghost of a smile fixed on her lips that Martin had noticed the day she turned up at his pool parlor. The rabbi bounded to his feet when the women appeared at the door. Yara stopped to kiss the mezuzah before she came in. Grabbing one of her hands in both of his, bending at the waist so that his head was level with hers, the rabbi bombarded her with a burst of Hebrew, which, to the Seamus's ear, sounded more like Brooklyn than biblical. Martin concluded that the rabbi was offering condolences because Yara started sobbing again. Tears cascaded down her cheeks and soaked into the tightly buttoned collar of her blouse. Ben Zion led Yara to the Yartzeit candle and, rocking back and forth on the soles of his sneakers, started praying in Hebrew. Yara, blotting her tears on the back of a sleeve, joined in.
"He is saying Kaddish," Stella whispered to Martin. "It's the Jewish prayer for the dead."
"Aren't you going to say Kaddish for your father?" he whispered back.
"I only pray for the living," she retorted fiercely.
When the prayer ended, the rabbi excused himself to organize the Sabbath pilgrimage to the cave of Machpelah, and Martin got his first opportunity to talk to Stella's sister.
"I'm sorry about your father," he began.
She accepted this with a shy closing of her lids.
"I was not expecting him to die, and certainly not of a heart attack. He had the heart of a lion. After all he had been through..."
She shrugged weakly. "Your sister has hired me to find Samat so that you can get a religious divorce." Yara turned on Stella.
"What good will a divorce do me?"
"It's a matter of pride," Stella insisted. "You can't let him get away with this."
Martin steered the conversation back to matters of tradecraft. "Do you have anything of his? A book he once read, a telephone he once used, a bottle of alcohol he once poured a drink from, a toothbrush even, anything at all?" Yara shook her head.
"There was stationery with a London letterhead, but it disappeared, and I don't remember the address on it. Samat filled a trunk with personal belongings and paid two boys to carry it down to the taxi when he left. He even took the photographs of our wedding. The only photograph left of him was the one Stella snapped after the ceremony and sent to our father."
At the mention of her father, tears trickled down her cheeks again.
"How could Samat do this to a wife, I ask you?"
"Stella told me he was always talking on the phone," Martin said. "Did he initiate the calls, or did people call him?"
"Both."
"So there must be phone records showing the numbers he dialed." Again she shook her head.
"The rabbi asked the security office here to try and get the phone numbers. Someone even drove to Tel Aviv to interview the phone company. He reported back that the numbers were all on a magnetic tape that had been erased by error. There was no trace of the numbers he called."
"What language did he use when he spoke on the phone?"
"English, Russian, Armenian sometimes."
"Did you ever ask him what he did for a living?"
"Once."
Stella said, "What did he say?"
"At first he didn't answer. When I pressed him, he told me he ran a business selling Western-manufactured artificial limbs to people who had lost legs to Russian landmines in Bosnia, Chechnya, Kurdistan. He said he could have made a fortune but was selling them at cost."
"And you believed him?" Stella asked.
"I had no reason not to."
Yara's eyes suddenly widened.
"Someone once called when he wasn't here and left a phone number for him to call back. I thought it might have something to do with these artificial limbs, and wrote it down on the first thing that came to hand, which was the back of a recipe, and then copied it onto the pad next to the telephone. I tore off the page and gave it to Samat when he returned to the house that day, and he went to the bedroom and dialed a number. I remember that the conversation was very agitated. At one point, Samat was even yelling into the phone, and he kept switching from English to Russian and back to English again."
"That recipe," Stella said softly. Do you still have it?
Both Stella and Martin could see Yara hesitate.
You would not be betraying your husband, Martin said. If and when we find him, we are only going to make sure you get the famous get so you can go on with your life.
Samat owes that much to you, Stella said.
Sighing, moving as if her limbs were weighted down by gravity, Yara pushed herself to her feet and shuffled into the kitchen alcove and pulled a tin box from one of the wall cupboards. She carried it back to the living room, set it on the folding table, opened the lid, and began thumbing through printed recipes that she had torn out of Elle magazine over the years. She pulled the one for apple strudel out of the box and turned it over. A phone number starting with the country code 44 and city code 171 was scrawled on the back in pencil. Martin produced a felt-tipped pen and copied the number into a small notebook.
"Where is that?" Stella asked Martin.
44 is England. 171 is London, he said. He turned back to Stella.
"Did Samat ever leave Kiryat Arba?" he asked.
"Once, sometimes twice a week, he drove off by himself, sometimes for a few hours, sometimes for several days."
"Do you have any idea where he went?"
"The one time I asked him, he told me it was not the business of a wife to keep track of a husband."
Stella looked brightly at Martin.
"We went with him once, Martin."
She smiled at her half-sister.
"Don't you remember, Yelena?"
"My name is Kiara now,"
Stella's sister reminded her coldly. Stella was not put off.
"It was when I came for the wedding," she said excitedly. "I had to be at Ben-Gurion Airport at 7 in the evening for my flight back to New York. Samat was going somewhere for lunch. He said if we didn't mind killing time, he had to see someone on the coast and could drop me at the airport on the way back to Kiryat Arba."
"I remember that," Yara said. "We made bologna sandwiches and packed them in a paper bag and took a plastic bottle of apple juice."
She sighed again.
"That was one of the happiest days of my life," she added.
Stella said to Martin,
"He drove north from Tel Aviv along the expressway and got off at the exit marked Caesarea. There was a labyrinth of streets, but he never hesitated. He seemed to know his way around very well. He dropped us on the edge of the sand dunes near some A-frame houses. We could see those giant chimneys down the coast that produced electricity."
Yara's face lit up for the first time in Martin's presence. The smile almost made her look handsome.
"I wore an enormous straw hat to protect my face from the sun," she recalled. "We ate in the shade of a eucalyptus tree and then hunted for Roman coins in the sand."
"And what did Samat do while you were scouring the dunes for Roman coins?" Martin asked. The girls looked at each other.
"He never told us.
He picked us up at the A-frames at 5:30 and dropped me off at the airport at 6:40. "Uh-huh," Martin said, his brows knitting as he began to fit the first blurred pieces of the jigsaw puzzle into place. Martin took a tiny address book. Tradecraft ruled. Everyone in it was identified by nickname, and phone numbers were masked in a simple cipher. From his pocket, and used his AT&T card to call Xing's Mandarin Restaurant, listed in the address book as Glutamate, under the pool parlor on Albany Avenue in Crown Heights. Given the time difference, Tso would be presiding from the high stool behind the cash register, glowering at the waitress who had replaced Min if she failed to push the more expensive dishes on the menu.
"Peking duck hanging in window for 2 days,"
he'd once informed Min, his gold teeth glistening with saliva, his face a mask of earnestness. So she had gleefully recounted to Martin.
"Is aphrodisiac good for elections?"
End of disc 3. Please continue with the next disc.